Chapter 6 Continued. Set against the dull, poster-muffled shop-fronts around them, Fred and George's windows hit the eye like a firework display. Casual passers-by were looking back over their shoulders at the windows, and a few rather stunned-looking people had actually come to a halt, transfixed. The left-hand window was dazzlingly full of an assortment of goods that revolved, popped, flashed, bounced, and shrieked. Harry's eyes began to water just looking at it. The right-hand window was covered with a gigantic poster, purple like those of the ministry, but emblazoned with flashing yellow letters. "Why are you worrying about you-know-who? You should be worrying about you-know-poo, the constipation sensation that's gripping the nation." Harry started to laugh. He heard a weak sort of moan beside him and looked round to see Mrs. Weasley gazing dumbfounded at the poster. Her lips moved silently, mouthing the name. "You-know-poo? They'll be murdered in their beds," she whispered. "No, they won't," said Ron, who, like Harry, was laughing. "This is brilliant." And he and Harry led the way into the shop. It was packed with customers. Harry could not get near the shelves. He stared around, looking up at the boxes piled to the ceiling. Here were the skiving snack boxes that the twins had perfected during their last unfinished year at Hogwarts. Harry noticed that the nosebleed nougat was most popular, with only one battered box left on the shelf. There were bins full of trick wands, the cheapest merely turning into rubber chickens or pairs of pants when waved, the most expensive beating the unwary user around the head and neck. Boxes of quills, which came in self-inking, spell-checking, and smart-answer varieties. A space cleared in the crowd, and Harry pushed his way towards the counter, where a gaggle of delighted 10-year-olds was watching a tiny little wooden man slowly ascending the steps to a real set of gallows, both perched on a box that read, "Reusable Hangman. Spell it, or he'll swing." "Patented daydream charms!" Hermione had managed to squeeze through to a large display near the counter and was reading the information on the back of a box bearing a highly coloured picture of a handsome youth and a swooning girl who were standing on the deck of a pirate ship. "One simple incantation, and you will enter a top-quality, highly realistic 30-minute daydream. Easy to fit into the average school lesson and virtually undetectable. Side effects include vacant expression and minor drooling. Not for sale to under-16s. "You know," said Hermione, looking up at Harry, "that really is extraordinary magic." "For that, Hermione," said a voice behind them, "you can have one for free." A beaming Fred stood before them, wearing a set of magenta robes that clashed magnificently with his flaming hair. "How are you, Harry?" They shook hands. "What's happened to your eye, Hermione?" "Your punching telescope," she said ruefully. "Oh, blimey, I forgot about those," said Fred. "Here." He pulled a tub out of his pocket and handed it to her. She unscrewed it gingerly to reveal a thick yellow paste. "Just dab it on. That bruise will be gone within the hour," said Fred. "We had to find a decent bruise remover. We're testing most of our products on ourselves." Hermione looked nervous. "It is safe, isn't it?"
"Course it is," said Fred, bracingly. "Come on, Harry. I'll give you a tour."
Harry left Hermione dabbing her black eye with paste and followed Fred towards the back of the shop, where he saw a stand of card and rope tricks.
"Muggle magic tricks," said Fred happily, pointing them out.
"For freaks like Dad, you know, who love muggle stuff. It's not a big earner, but we do fairly steady business. They're great novelties. Oh, here's George." Fred's twin shook Harry's hand energetically.
"Giving him the tour? Come through to the back, Harry. That's where we're making the real money." "Pocket anything, you, and you'll pay in more than galleons," he added warningly to a small boy who hastily whipped his hand out of the tub labelled, "Edible dark marks, they'll make anyone sick."
George pushed back a curtain beside the Muggle tricks, and Harry saw a darker, less crowded room. The packaging on the products lining these shelves was more subdued.
"We've just developed this more serious line," said Fred. "Funny how it happened. You wouldn't believe how many people, even people who work at the Ministry, can't do a decent shield charm," said George.
"Course they didn't have you teaching them, Harry."
"That's right. Well, we thought shield hats were a bit of a laugh. You know, challenge your mate to jinx you while wearing it, and watch his face when the jinx just bounces off. But the Ministry bought 500 for all its support staff, and we're still getting massive orders. So we've expanded into a range of shield cloaks, shield gloves. I mean, they wouldn't help much against the unforgivable curses, but for minor to moderate hexes or jinxes. And then we thought we'd get into the whole area of defence against the dark arts, because it's such a money spinner," continued George enthusiastically. "This is cool. Look, instant darkness powder. We're importing it from Peru. Handy if you want to make a quick escape. And our decoy detonators are just walking off the shelves. Look," said Fred, pointing at a number of weird-looking black hooter-type objects that were indeed attempting to scurry out of sight. "You just drop one surreptitiously, and it'll run off and make a nice loud noise out of sight, giving you a diversion if you need one."
"Handy," said Harry, impressed.
"Here," said George, catching a couple and throwing them to Harry.
A young witch with short blonde hair poked her head round the curtain. Harry saw that she too was wearing magenta staff robes.
"There's a customer out here looking for a joke cauldron, Mr. Weasley and Mr. Weasley," she said.
Harry found it very odd to hear Fred and George called Mr. Weasley, but they took it in their stride.
"Right you are, Verity, I'm coming," said George promptly. "Harry, you help yourself to anything you want, all right? No charge."
"I can't do that," said Harry, who had already pulled out his money bag to pay for the decoy detonators.
"You don't pay here," said Fred firmly, waving away Harry's gold.
"But you gave us our start-up loan. We haven't forgotten," said George sternly.
"Take whatever you like, and just remember to tell people where you got it if they ask."
George swept off through the curtain to help with the customers, and Fred led Harry back into the main part of the shop, to find Hermione and Ginny still poring over the patented daydream charms.
"Haven't you girls found our special Wonder Witch product yet?" asked Fred. "Follow me, ladies."
Near the window was an array of violently pink products, around which a cluster of excited girls was giggling enthusiastically. Hermione and Ginny both hung back, looking wary.
"There you go," said Fred proudly. "Best range of love potions you'll find anywhere."
Ginny raised an eyebrow sceptically.
"Do they work?"
"Certainly they work, for up to 24 hours at a time, depending on the weight of the boy in question, and the attractiveness of the girl," said George, reappearing suddenly at their side. "But we're not selling them to our sister," he added, becoming suddenly stern. "Not when she's already got about 5 boys on the go from what we've..."
"Whatever you've heard from Ron is a big, fat lie," said Ginny calmly, leaning forward to take a small pink pot off the shelf. "What's this?"
"Guaranteed 10-second pimple vanisher," said Fred. "Excellent on everything from boils to blackheads, but don't change the subject. Are you, or are you not, currently going out with a boy called Dean Thomas?"
"Yes, I am," said Ginny. "And last time I looked, he was definitely 1 boy, not 5. What are those?"
She was pointing at a number of round balls of fluff, in shades of pink and purple, all rolling around the bottom of a cage and emitting high-pitched squeaks.
"Pygmy puffs," said George. "Miniature puff skeins. We can't breed them fast enough. So what about Michael Corner?"
"I dumped him. He was a bad loser," said Ginny, putting a finger through the bars of the cage and watching the pygmy puffs crowd around it.
"They're really cute."
"They're fairly cuddly, yes," conceded Fred. "But you're moving through boyfriends a bit fast, aren't you?"
Ginny turned to look at him, her hands on her hips. There was such a Mrs. Weasley-ish glare on her face that Harry was surprised Fred didn't recoil.
"It's none of your business. And I'll thank you," she added angrily to Ron, who had just appeared at George's elbow, laden with merchandise, "not to tell tales about me to these two."
"That's 3 galleons, 9 sickles and a knut," said Fred, examining the many boxes in Ron's arms. "Cough up."
"I'm your brother."
"And that's our stuff you're nicking. 3 galleons, 9 sickles. I'll knock off the knut."
"But I haven't got 3 galleons, 9 sickles.
"You'd better put it all back, then, and mind you put it on the right shelves."
Ron dropped several boxes, swore, and made a rude hand gesture at Fred that was unfortunately spotted by Mrs. Weasley, who had chosen that moment to appear.
"If I see you do that again, I'll jinx your fingers together," she said sharply.
"Mum, can I have a pigmy puff?"
said Ginny at once.
"A what?" said Mrs. Weasley, warily.
"Look, they're so sweet."
Mrs. Weasley moved aside to look at the pigmy puffs, and Harry, Ron, and Hermione momentarily had an unimpeded view out of the window. Draco Malfoy was hurrying up the street, alone. As he passed Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, he glanced over his shoulder. Seconds later, he moved beyond the scope of the window, and they lost sight of him.
"Wonder where his mummy is," said Harry, frowning.
"Given her the slip by the looks of it," said Ron.
"Why, though?" said Hermione.
Harry said nothing. He was thinking too hard. Narcissa Malfoy would not have let her precious son out of her sight willingly. Malfoy must have made a real effort to free himself from her clutches. Harry, knowing and loathing Malfoy, was sure the reason could not be innocent. He glanced around. Mrs. Weasley and Ginny were bending over the pigmy puffs. Mr. Weasley was delightedly examining a pack of Muggle-marked playing cards. Fred and George were both helping customers. On the other side of the glass, Hagrid was standing with his back to them, looking up and down the street.
"Get under here, quick,"
said Harry, pulling his invisibility cloak out of his bag.
"Oh, I don't know, Harry," said Hermione, looking uncertainly towards Mrs. Weasley.
"Come on," said Ron.
She hesitated for a second longer, then ducked under the cloak with Harry and Ron. Nobody noticed them vanish. They were all too interested in Fred and George's products. Harry, Ron, and Hermione squeezed their way out of the door as quickly as they could, but by the time they gained the street, Malfoy had disappeared just as successfully as they had.
"He was going in that direction," murmured Harry as quietly as possible,
so that the humming Hagrid would not hear them.
"Come on."
They scurried along, peering left and right through shop windows and doors, until Hermione pointed ahead.
"That's him, isn't it?" she whispered. "Turning left."
"Big surprise," whispered Ron.
For Malfoy had glanced round, then slid into Nocturne Alley and out of sight.
"Quick, or we'll lose him," said Harry, speeding up.
"Our feet'll be seen,"
said Hermione anxiously, as the cloak flapped a little around their ankles. It was much more difficult hiding all three of them under it nowadays.
"It doesn't matter," said Harry impatiently. "Just hurry!"
But Nocturne Alley, the side street devoted to the dark arts, looked completely deserted. They peered into windows as they passed, but none of the shops seemed to have any customers at all. Harry supposed it was a bit of a giveaway in these dangerous and suspicious times to buy dark artifacts, or at least to be seen buying them. Hermione gave his arm a hard pinch.
"Ouch! Shh! Look! He's in there!"
she breathed in Harry's ear. They had drawn level with the only shop in Nocturne Alley that Harry had ever visited. Borgin and Burke's, which sold a wide variety of sinister objects. There, in the midst of the cases full of skulls and old bottles, stood Draco Malfoy, with his back to them, just visible beyond the very same large black cabinet in which Harry had once hidden to avoid Malfoy and his father.
Judging by the movements of Malfoy's hands, he was talking animatedly. The proprietor of the shop, Mr. Borgin, an oily-haired, stooping man, stood facing Malfoy. He was wearing a curious expression of mingled resentment and fear.
"If only we could hear what they're saying," said Hermione. "We can," said Ron excitedly. "Hang on. Damn."
He dropped a couple more of the boxes he was still clutching as he fumbled with the largest.
"Extendable ears. Look." "Fantastic," said Hermione,
as Ron unravelled the long, flesh-coloured strings and began to feed them towards the bottom of the door.
"Oh, I hope the door isn't imperturbable."
"No,"
said Ron gleefully.
"Listen."
They put their heads together and listened intently to the ends of the strings, through which Malfoy's voice could be heard loud and clear, as though a radio had been turned on.
"You know how to fix it?"
"Possibly," said Borgin in a tone that suggested he was unwilling to commit himself.
"I'll need to see it, though. Why don't you bring it into the shop?"
"I can't," said Malfoy. "It's got to stay put. I just need you to tell me how to do it." Harry saw Borgin lick his lips nervously.
"Well, without seeing it, I must say it will be a very difficult job, perhaps impossible. I couldn't guarantee anything."
"No," said Malfoy, and Harry knew just by his tone that Malfoy was sneering. "Perhaps this will make you more confident." He moved towards Borgin and was blocked from view by the cabinet. Harry, Ron and Hermione shuffled sideways to try and keep him in sight, but all they could see was Borgin looking very frightened.
"Tell anyone," said Malfoy, "and there will be retribution. You know Fenrir Greyback? He's a family friend. He'll be dropping in from time to time to make sure you're giving the problem your full attention."
"Oh, there will be no need for—"
"I'll decide that," said Malfoy. "Well, I'd better be off. And don't forget to keep that one safe. I'll need it."
"Perhaps you'd like to take it now?"
"No, of course I wouldn't, you stupid little man. How would I look carrying that down the street? Just don't sell it."
"Of course not, sir."
Borgin made a bow as deep as the one Harry had once seen him give Lucius Malfoy.
"Not a word to anyone, Borgin, and that includes my mother. Understand?"
"Naturally, naturally," murmured Borgin, bowing again.
Next moment, the bell over the door tinkled loudly as Malfoy stalked out of the shop, looking very pleased with himself. He passed so close to Harry, Ron, and Hermione that they felt the cloak flutter around their knees again. Inside the shop, Borgin remained frozen. His unctuous smile had vanished. He looked worried.
"What was that about?"
whispered Ron, reeling in the extendable ears.
"Dunno,"
said Harry, thinking hard.
"He wants something mended, and he wants to reserve something in there. Could you see what he pointed at when he said that one?"
"No, he was behind that cabinet."
"You two stay here,"
whispered Hermione.
"What do you—"
But Hermione had already ducked out from under the cloak. She checked her hair in the reflection in the glass, then marched into the shop, setting the bell tinkling again. Ron hastily fed the extendable ears back under the door and passed one of the strings to Harry.
"Hello. Horrible morning, isn't it?"
Hermione said brightly to Borgin, who did not answer, but cast her a suspicious look. Humming cheerily, Hermione strolled through the jumble of objects on display.
"Is this necklace for sale?"
she asked, pausing beside a glass-fronted case.
"If you've got 1,500 galleons," said Borgin coldly.
"Oh, no, I haven't got quite that much,"
said Hermione, walking on.
"And what about this lovely, skull?"
16 galleons."
"So it's for sale, then? It isn't being kept for anyone?"
Borgins squinted at her. Harry had the nasty feeling he knew exactly what Hermione was up to. Apparently Hermione felt she had been rumbled too, because she suddenly threw caution to the winds.
"The thing is, that, boy who was in here just now, Draco Malfoy, well, he's a friend of mine, and I want to get him a birthday present. But if he's already reserved anything, I obviously don't want to get him the same thing, so,
It was a pretty lame story, in Harry's opinion, and apparently Borgin thought so too.
"Out," he said sharply. "Get out."
Hermione did not wait to be asked twice, but hurried to the door with Borgin at her heels. As the bell tinkled again, Borgin slammed the door behind her and put up the closed sign.
"Oh, well," said Ron, throwing the cloak back over Hermione. "Worth a try, but you were a bit obvious."
"Well, next time you can show me how it's done, Master of Mystery," she snapped.
Ron and Hermione bickered all the way back to Weasley's Wizard Wheezy's, where they were forced to stop so that they could dodge undetected around a very anxious-looking Mrs. Weasley and Hagrid, who had clearly noticed their absence. Once in the shop, Harry whipped off the invisibility cloak, hid it in his bag, and joined in with the other two, when they insisted, in answer to Mrs. Weasley's accusations, that they had been in the back room all along, and that she could not have looked properly.
Chapter 7. The Slug Club. Harry spent a lot of the last week of the holidays pondering the meaning of Malfoy's behaviour in Nocturne Alley. What disturbed him most was the satisfied look on Malfoy's face as he had left the shop. Nothing that made Malfoy look happy could be good news. To his slight annoyance, however, neither Ron nor Hermione seemed quite as curious about Malfoy's activities as he was. Or at least, they seemed to get bored of discussing it after a few days.
"Yes, I've already agreed it was fishy, Harry," said Hermione, a little impatiently.
She was sitting on the window-sill in Fred and George's room with her feet up on one of the cardboard boxes, and had only grudgingly looked up from her new copy of Advanced Rune Translation.
"But haven't we agreed there could be a lot of explanations?"
"Maybe he's broken his hand of glory," said Ron vaguely, as he attempted to straighten his broomstick's bent tail twigs. "Remember that shrivelled-up arm Malfoy had?"
"But what about when he said, 'Don't forget to keep that one safe?'" asked Harry for the umpteenth time. "That sounded to me like Borgin's got another one of the broken objects, and Malfoy wants both."
"You reckon?" said Ron, now trying to scrape some dirt off his broom-handle.
"Yeah, I do," said Harry.
When neither Ron nor Hermione answered, he said, "Malfoy's father's in Azkaban. Don't you think Malfoy'd like revenge?" Ron looked up, blinking.
"Malfoy, revenge? What can he do about it?"
"That's my point. I don't know," said Harry, frustrated. "But he's up to something, and I think we should take it seriously. His father's a Death Eater and—"
Harry broke off, his eyes fixed on the window behind Hermione, his mouth open. A startling thought had just occurred to him.
"Harry," said Hermione in an anxious voice, "what's wrong?"
"Your scar's not hurting again, is it?" asked Ron nervously.
"He's a Death Eater," said Harry slowly. "He's replaced his father as a Death Eater." There was a silence. Then Ron erupted in laughter.
"Malfoy is 16, Harry. You think you-know-who would let Malfoy join?"
"It seems very unlikely, Harry," said Hermione in a repressive sort of voice.
"What makes you think in Madame Malkin's? She didn't touch him, but he yelled and jerked his arm away from her when she went to roll up his sleeve. It was his left arm. He's been branded with the dark mark."
Ron and Hermione looked at each other.
"Well,"
said Ron, sounding thoroughly unconvinced.
"I think he just wanted to get out of there, Harry," said Hermione.
"He showed Borgins something we couldn't see," Harry pressed on stubbornly. "Something that seriously scared Borgin. It was the mark. I know it. He was showing Borgin who he was dealing with. You saw how seriously Borgin took him."
Ron and Hermione exchanged another look. "I'm not sure, Harry."
"Yeah, I still don't reckon you know who would let Malfoy join."
Annoyed, but absolutely convinced he was right, Harry snatched up a pile of filthy Quidditch robes and left the room.
Mrs. Weasley had been urging them for days not to leave their washing and packing until the last moment. On the landing, he bumped into Ginny, who was returning to her room, carrying a pile of freshly laundered clothes.
"I wouldn't go in the kitchen just now," she warned him. "There's a lot of phlegm around."
"I'll be careful not to slip in it," smiled Harry. Sure enough, when he entered the kitchen, it was to find Fleur sitting at the kitchen table, in full flow about plans for her wedding to Bill, while Mrs. Weasley kept watch over a pile of self-peeling sprouts, looking bad-tempered.
"Bill and I have almost decided on only two bridesmaids. Ginny and Gabrielle will look very sweet together. I am thinking of dressing them in pale gold.
Pink would, of course, be horrible with Ginny's hair."
"Ah, Harry," said Mrs. Weasley loudly, cutting across Fleur's monologue. "Good. I wanted to explain about the security arrangements for the journey to Hogwarts tomorrow. We've got ministry cars again, and there will be auras waiting at the station.
Is Tonks going to be there?" asked Harry, handing over his Quidditch things.
"No, I don't think so. She's been stationed somewhere else, from what Arthur said."
"She has let herself go that Tonks," mused Fleur,
examining her own stunning reflection in the back of a teaspoon.
"A big mistake, if you ask."
"Yes, thank you," said Mrs. Weasley tartly, cutting across Fleur again. "You'd better get on, Harry. I want the trunks ready tonight, if possible, so we don't have the usual last-minute scramble."
And in fact, their departure the following morning was smoother than usual. The ministry cars glided up to the front of the burrow to find them waiting, trunks packed, Hermione's cat Crookshanks safely enclosed in his travelling basket, and Hedwig, Ron's owl Pigwidgeon, and Ginny's new purple pygmy puff Arnold in cages.
"Au revoir, Harry," said Fleur throatily, kissing him goodbye.
Ron hurried forwards, looking hopeful, but Ginny stuck out her foot and Ron fell, sprawling in the dust at Fleur's feet. Furious, red-faced and dirt-spattered, he hurried into the car without saying good-bye. There was no cheerful Hagrid waiting for them at King's Cross Station. Instead, two grim-faced, bearded aurors in dark muggle suits moved forwards the moment the cars stopped and, flanking the party, marched them into the station without speaking.
"Quick, quick, through the barrier," said Mrs. Weasley, who seemed a little flustered by this austere efficiency. "Harry had better go first with—"
She looked inquiringly at one of the aurors, who nodded briefly, seized Harry's upper arm, and attempted to steer him towards the barrier between platforms 9 and 10.
"I can walk, thanks," said Harry irritably, jerking his arm out of the aura's grip. He pushed his trolley directly at the solid barrier, ignoring his silent companion, and found himself, a second later, standing on platform 9 3/4, where the Scarlet Hogwarts Express stood belching steam over the crowd. Hermione and the Weasleys joined him within seconds. Without waiting to consult his grim-faced aura, Harry motioned to Ron and Hermione to follow him up the platform, looking for an empty compartment.
"We can't, Harry," said Hermione, looking apologetic. "Ron and I've got to go to the prefect carriage first, and then patrol the corridors for a bit."
"Oh, yeah, I forgot," said Harry.
"You'd better get straight on the train, all of you. You've only got a few minutes to go," said Mrs. Weasley, consulting her watch. "Well, have a lovely term, Ron. Mr. Weasley, can I have a quick word?" said Harry, making up his mind on the spur of the moment.
"Of course," said Mr. Weasley, who looked slightly surprised, but followed Harry out of earshot of the others nevertheless. Harry had thought it through carefully, and come to the conclusion that if he were to tell anyone, Mr. Weasley would be the right person. Firstly, because he worked at the Ministry, and was therefore in the best position to make further investigations, and secondly, because he thought that there was not too much risk of Mr. Weasley exploding with anger. He could see Mrs. Weasley and the grim-faced Aura casting the pair of them suspicious looks as they moved away. "When we were in Diagon Alley," Harry began, but Mr. Weasley forestalled him with a grimace. "Am I about to discover where you, Ron, and Hermione disappeared to while you were supposed to be in the back room of Fred and George's shop? How did you—" "Harry, please, you're talking to the man who raised Fred and George." "Yeah, all right. We weren't in the back room." "Very well, then. Let's hear the worst." "Well, we followed Draco Malfoy. We used my invisibility cloak." "Did you have any particular reason for doing so, or was it a mere whim?" "Because I thought Malfoy was up to something," said Harry, disregarding Mr. Weasley's look of mingled exasperation and amusement. "He'd given his mother the slip, and I wanted to know why." "Of course you did," said Mr. Weasley, sounding resigned. "Well, did you find out why?" "He went into Borgin and Burke's," said Harry, "and started bullying the bloke in there, Borgin, to help him fix something. And he said he wanted Borgin to keep something else for him. He made it sound like it was the same kind of thing that needed fixing, like they were a pair, and—" Harry took a deep breath. "There's something else. We saw Malfoy jump about a mile when Madame Malkin tried to touch his left arm. I think he's been branded with the Dark Mark. I think he's replaced his father as a Death Eater." Mr. Weasley looked taken aback. After a moment he said, "Harry, I doubt whether you-know-who would allow a 16-year-old—" "Does anyone really know what you-know-who would or wouldn't do?" asked Harry angrily. "Mr. Weasley, I'm sorry, but isn't it worth investigating? If Malfoy wants something fixing, and he needs to threaten Borgin to get it done, it's probably something dark or dangerous, isn't it?"
"I doubt it, to be honest, Harry," said Mr. Weasley slowly. "You see, when Lucius Malfoy was arrested, we raided his house. We took away everything that might have been dangerous."
"I think you missed something," said Harry stubbornly.
"Well, maybe," said Mr. Weasley, but Harry could tell that Mr. Weasley was humouring him.
There was a whistle behind them. Nearly everyone had boarded the train, and the doors were closing.
"You'd better hurry," said Mr. Weasley, as Mrs. Weasley cried, "Harry, quickly!"
He hurried forwards, and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley helped him load his trunk onto the train.
"Now, dear, you're coming to us for Christmas. It's all fixed with Dumbledore, so we'll see you quite soon,"
said Mrs. Weasley through the window, as Harry slammed the door shut behind him, and the train began to move.
"You make sure you look after yourself, and—"
The train was gathering speed.
"Be good, and—"
She was jogging to keep up now.
"Stay safe."
Harry waved until the train had turned a corner and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley were lost from view, then turned to see where the others had got to. He supposed Ron and Hermione were cloistered in the prefect carriage, but Ginny was a little way along the corridor, chatting to some friends. He made his way towards her, dragging his trunk. People stared shamelessly as he approached. They even pressed their faces against the windows of their compartments to get a look at him. He had expected an upswing in the amount of gaping and gawping he would have to endure this term after all the Chosen One rumours in the Daily Prophet, but he did not enjoy the sensation of standing in a very bright spotlight. He tapped Ginny on the shoulder. "Fancy trying to find a compartment?"
"I can't, Harry. I said I'd meet Dean," said Ginny brightly. "See you later."
"Right," said Harry. He felt a strange twinge of annoyance as she walked away, her long red hair dancing behind her. He had become so used to her presence over the summer that he had almost forgotten that Ginny did not hang around with him, Ron, and Hermione while at school. Then he blinked and looked around. He was surrounded by mesmerized girls.
"Hi, Harry," said a familiar voice from behind him.
"Neville," said Harry in relief, turning to see a round-faced boy struggling towards him.
"Hello, Harry," said a girl with long hair and large, misty eyes who was just behind Neville.
"Luna, hi, how are you?"
"Very well, thank you," said Luna.
She was clutching a magazine to her chest. Large letters on the front announced that there was a pair of free spectre specs inside. "The Quibbler still going strong, then?" asked Harry, who felt a certain fondness for the magazine, having given it an exclusive interview the previous year.
"Oh, yes, circulation's well up," said Luna happily.
"Let's find seats," said Harry, and the three of them set off along the train through hordes of silently staring students. At last they found an empty compartment, and Harry hurried inside gratefully.
"They're even staring at us," said Neville, indicating himself and Luna, "because we're with you."
"They're staring at you because you were at the ministry too," said Harry, as he hoisted his trunk into the luggage rack.
"Our little adventure there was all over the Daily Prophet. You must have seen it."
"Yes, I thought Gran would be angry about all the publicity," said Neville, "but she was really pleased. Says I'm starting to live up to my dad at long last. She bought me a new wand. Look!"
He pulled it out and showed it to Harry.
"Cherry and unicorn hair," he said proudly. "We think it was one of the last Ollivander ever sold. He vanished next day.
Oi! Come back here, Trevor!"
And he dived under the seat to retrieve his toad as it made one of its frequent bids for freedom.
"Are we still doing DA meetings this year, Harry?" asked Luna, who was detaching a pair of psychedelic spectacles from the middle of the Quibbler.
"No point now we've got rid of Umbridge, is there?" said Harry, sitting down.
Neville bumped his head against the seat as he emerged from under it. He looked most disappointed.
"I liked the DA. I learned loads with you."
"I enjoyed the meetings too," said Luna serenely. "It was like having friends."
This was one of those uncomfortable things Luna often said, and which made Harry feel a squirming mixture of pity and embarrassment. Before he could respond, however, there was a disturbance outside their compartment door. A group of fourth-year girls was whispering and giggling together on the other side of the glass.
"You ask him." "No, you. I'll do it."
And one of them, a bold-looking girl with large dark eyes, a prominent chin and long black hair, pushed her way through the door.
"Hi, Harry. I'm Romilda. Romilda Vane," she said loudly and confidently. "Why don't you join us in our compartment?
You don't have to sit with them," she added in a stage whisper, indicating Neville's bottom, which was sticking out from under the seat again as he groped around for Trevor,
and Luna, who was now wearing her free spectre specs, which gave her the look of a demented, multicoloured owl.
"They're friends of mine," said Harry coldly.
"Oh," said the girl, looking very surprised.
"Oh, okay."
And she withdrew, sliding the door closed behind her.
"People expect you to have cooler friends than us," said Luna, once again displaying her knack for embarrassing honesty.
"You are cool," said Harry shortly. "None of them was at the ministry. They didn't fight with me."
"That's a very nice thing to say," beamed Luna, and she pushed her spectre specs further up her nose and settled down to read the Quibbler.
"We didn't face him, though," said Neville, emerging from under the seat with fluff and dust in his hair and a resigned-looking Trevor in his hand. "You did. You should hear my gran talk about you. That Harry Potter's got more backbone than the whole Ministry of Magic put together. She'd give anything to have you as a grandson."
Harry laughed uncomfortably and changed the subject to OWL results as soon as he could.
While Neville recited his grades and wondered aloud whether he would be allowed to take a Transfiguration NEWT with only an acceptable, Harry watched him without really listening. Neville's childhood had been blighted by Voldemort just as much as Harry's had, but Neville had no idea how close he had come to having Harry's destiny. The prophecy could have referred to either of them, yet for his own inscrutable reasons, Voldemort had chosen to believe that Harry was the one meant. Had Voldemort chosen Neville, it would be Neville sitting opposite Harry bearing the lightning-shaped scar and the weight of the prophecy. Or would it? Would Neville's mother have died to save him, as Lily had died for Harry? Surely she would. But what if she had been unable to stand between her son and Voldemort? Would there then have been no chosen one at all? An empty seat where Neville now sat, and a scarless Harry, who would have been kissed goodbye by his own mother, not Ron's. "You all right, Harry? You look funny," said Neville. Harry started. "Sorry, I..."
"Raxbert got you?" asked Luna sympathetically, peering at Harry through her enormous coloured spectacles.
"I... what?"
"A Raxbert. They're invisible. They float in through your ears and make your brain go fuzzy," she said. "I thought I felt one zooming around in here."
She flapped her hands at thin air, as though beating off large invisible moths. Harry and Neville caught each other's eye and hastily began to talk of Quidditch. The weather beyond the train windows was as patchy as it had been all summer. They passed through stretches of the chilling mist, then out into weak, clear sunlight. It was during one of the clear spells, when the sun was visible almost directly overhead, that Ron and Hermione entered the compartment at last.
"Wish the lunch trolley would hurry up. I'm starving," said Ron longingly, slumping into the seat beside Harry and rubbing his stomach. "Hi, Neville. Hi, Luna. Guess what?" he added, turning to Harry. "Malfoy's not doing prefect duty. He's just sitting in his compartment with the other Slytherins. We saw him when we passed."
Harry sat up straight, interested. It was not like Malfoy to pass up the chance to demonstrate his power as prefect, which he had happily abused all the previous year.
"What did he do when he saw you?"
"The usual," said Ron indifferently, demonstrating a rude hand gesture. "Not like him, though, is it?" "Well, that is." He did the hand gesture again.
"But why isn't he out there bullying first years?"
"Dunno," said Harry, but his mind was racing.
Didn't this look as though Malfoy had more important things on his mind than bullying younger students?
"Maybe he preferred the inquisitorial squad," said Hermione. "Maybe being a prefect seems a bit tame after that."
"I don't think so," said Harry.
"I think he's..." But before he could expound on his theory, the compartment door slid open again, and a breathless third-year girl stepped inside.
"I'm supposed to deliver these to Neville Longbottom and Harry Potter," she faltered, as her eyes met Harry's and she turned scarlet. She was holding out two scrolls of parchment tied with violet ribbon. Perplexed, Harry and Neville took the scroll addressed to each of them, and the girl stumbled back out of the compartment.
"What is it?" Ron demanded, as Harry unrolled his.
"An invitation," said Harry.
"Harry, I would be delighted if you would join me for a bite of lunch in Compartment C. Sincerely, Professor H.E.F. Slughorn."
"Who's Professor Slughorn?" asked Neville, looking perplexedly at his own invitation.
"New teacher," said Harry.
"Well, I suppose we'll have to go, won't we?"
"But what does he want me for?" asked Neville nervously, as though he were expecting detention.
"No idea," said Harry, which was not entirely true, though he had no proof yet that his hunch was correct.
"Listen," he added, seized by a sudden brainwave, "let's go under the invisibility cloak. Then we might get a good look at Malfoy on the way, see what he's up to."
This idea, however, came to nothing. The corridors, which were packed with people on the lookout for the lunch trolley, were impossible to negotiate while wearing the cloak. Harry stowed it regretfully back in his bag, reflecting that it would have been nice to wear it just to avoid all the staring, which seemed to have increased in intensity even since he had last walked down the train. Every now and then students would hurtle out of their compartments to get a better look at him. The exception was Cho Chang, who darted into her compartment when she saw Harry coming. As Harry passed the window, he saw her deep in determined conversation with her friend Marietta, who was wearing a very thick layer of makeup that did not entirely obscure the odd formation of pimples still etched across her face. Smirking slightly, Harry pushed on. When they reached Compartment C, they saw at once that they were not Slughorn's only invitees, although judging by the enthusiasm of Slughorn's welcome, Harry was the most warmly anticipated.
"Harry, my boy,"
said Slughorn, jumping up at the sight of him, so that his great velvet-covered belly seemed to fill all the remaining space in the compartment. His shiny bald head and great silver moustache gleamed as brightly in the sunlight as the golden buttons on his waistcoat.
"Good to see you. Good to see you. And you must be Mr. Longbottom."
Neville nodded, looking scared. At a gesture from Slughorn, they sat down opposite each other in the only two empty seats, which were nearest the door. Harry glanced around at their fellow guests. He recognised a Slytherin from their year, a tall black boy with high cheekbones and long, slanting eyes. There were also two seventh-year boys Harry did not know, and, squashed in the corner beside Slughorn, and looking as though she was not entirely sure how she had got there, Ginny.
"Now, do you know everyone?" Slughorn asked Harry and Neville. "Blaise Zabini is in your year, of course."
Zabini did not make any sign of recognition or greeting, and nor did Harry or Neville. Gryffindor and Slytherin students loathed each other on principle.
"This is Cormac McLaggen. Perhaps you've come across each other? No?"
McLaggen, a large, wire-haired youth, raised a hand, and Harry and Neville nodded back at him.
"And this is Marcus Belby. I don't know whether,
Belby, who was thin and nervous-looking, gave a strained smile.
"And this charming young lady tells me she knows you," Slughorn finished.
Ginny grimaced at Harry and Neville from behind Slughorn's back.
"Well, now, this is most pleasant," said Slughorn cosily. "A chance to get to know you all a little better. Here, take a napkin. I've packed my own lunch. The trolley, as I remember it, is heavy on licorice wands, and a poor old man's digestive system isn't quite up to such things. Pheasant, Belby?"
Belby started and accepted what looked like half a cold pheasant.
"I was just telling young Marcus here that I had the pleasure of teaching his uncle Damocles,"
Slughorn told Harry and Neville, now passing around a basket of rolls.
"Outstanding wizard, outstanding, and his Order of Merlin most well deserved. Do you see much of your uncle, Marcus?"
Unfortunately, Belby had just taken a large mouthful of pheasant. In his haste to answer Slughorn, he swallowed too fast, turned purple, and began to choke.
"Anapneo,"
said Slughorn calmly, pointing his wand at Belby, whose airway seemed to clear at once.
"Not much of him, no,"
gasped Belby, his eyes streaming.
"Well, of course, I dare say he's busy,"
said Slughorn, looking questioningly at Belby.
"I doubt he invented the wolfsbane potion without considerable hard work."
"I suppose," said Belby, who seemed afraid to take another bite of pheasant until he was sure that Slughorn had finished with him.
"He and my dad don't get on very well, you see, so I don't really know much about—"
His voice tailed away as Slughorn gave him a cold smile and turned to McLaggen instead.
"Now you, Cormac," said Slughorn, "I happen to know you see a lot of your uncle Tiberius because he has a rather splendid picture of the two of you hunting nogtails in, I think, Norfolk."
"Oh, yeah, that was fun, that was," said McLaggen. "We went with Bertie Higgs and Rufus Scrimgeour. This was before he became minister, obviously."
"Ah, you know Bertie and Rufus, too,"
beamed Slughorn, now offering around a small tray of pies. Somehow Belby was missed out.
"Now tell me."
It was as Harry had suspected. Everyone here seemed to have been invited because they were connected to somebody well-known or influential. Everyone except Ginny. Zabini, who was interrogated after McLaggen, turned out to have a famously beautiful witch for a mother. From what Harry could make out, she had been married 7 times, each of her husbands dying mysteriously and leaving her mounds of gold. It was Neville's turn next. This was a very uncomfortable 10 minutes, for Neville's parents, well-known aurors, had been tortured into insanity by Bellatrix Lestrange and a couple of Death-Eater cronies. At the end of Neville's interview, Harry had the impression that Slughorn was reserving judgment on Neville, yet to see whether he had any of his parents' flair.
"And now," said Slughorn, shifting massively in his seat, with the air of a compere introducing his star act, "Harry Potter."
"Where to begin? I feel I barely scratched the surface when we met over the summer."
He contemplated Harry for a moment as though he were a particularly large and succulent piece of pheasant, then said,
"The Chosen One, they're calling you now."
Harry said nothing. Belby, McLagan, and Zabini were all staring at him.
"Of course," said Slughorn, watching Harry closely, "there have been rumours for years. I remember when, well, after that terrible night, Lily, James, and you survived. And the word was that you must have powers beyond the ordinary."
Zabini gave a tiny little cough that was clearly supposed to indicate amused scepticism. An angry voice burst out from behind Slughorn.
"Yes, Zabini, because you're so talented at posing."
"Oh, dear," chuckled Slughorn comfortably, looking round at Ginny, who was glaring at Zabini around Slughorn's great belly. "You want to be careful, Blaze. I saw this young lady perform the most marvellous bat bogey hex as I was passing her carriage. I wouldn't cross her."
Zabini merely looked contemptuous.
"Anyway," said Slughorn, turning back to Harry, "such rumours this summer. Of course one doesn't know what to believe. The Prophet has been known to print inaccuracies, make mistakes, but there seems little doubt, given the number of witnesses, that there was quite a disturbance at the Ministry, and that you were there in the thick of it all."
Harry, who could not see any way out of this without flatly lying, nodded but still said nothing. Slughorn beamed at him.
"So modest, so modest. No wonder Dumbledore is so fond. You were there, then. But the rest of the stories, so sensational, of course, one doesn't know quite what to believe. This fabled prophecy, for instance."
"We never heard a prophecy," said Neville, turning geranium pink as he said it.
"That's right," said Ginny staunchly. "Neville and I were both there too, and all this Chosen One rubbish is just the Prophet making things up as usual."
"You were both there too, were you?" said Slughorn with great interest, looking from Ginny to Neville, but both of them sat clam-like before his encouraging smile. "Yes, well, it is true that the Prophet often exaggerates, of course," Slughorn continued, sounding a little disappointed. "I remember dear Gwenog telling me, Gwenog Jones, I mean, of course, captain of the Holyhead Harpies."
He meandered off into a long-winded reminiscence, but Harry had the distinct impression that Slughorn had not finished with him, and that he had not been convinced by Neville and Ginny. The afternoon wore on with more anecdotes about illustrious wizards Slughorn had taught, all of whom had been delighted to join what he called the Slug Club at Hogwarts. Harry could not wait to leave, but couldn't see how to do so politely. Finally, the train emerged from yet another long, misty stretch into a red sunset, and Slughorn looked around, blinking in the twilight.
"Good gracious, it's getting dark already. I didn't notice that they'd lit the lamps. You'd better go and change into your robes, all of you. McLagan, you must drop by and borrow that book on Nogtails. Harry, Blaze, any time you're passing." "Same goes for you, miss," he twinkled at Ginny. "Well, off you go, off you go."
As he pushed past Harry into the darkening corridor, Zabini shot him a filthy look that Harry returned with interest. He, Ginny, and Neville followed Zabini back along the train.
"I'm glad that's over," muttered Neville. "Strange man, isn't he?"
"Yeah, he's a bit," said Harry, his eyes on Zabini.
"How come you ended up in there, Ginny?"
"He saw me hex Zachariah Smith,"
said Ginny. "You remember that idiot from Hufflepuff who was in the DA? He kept on and on asking about what happened at the Ministry, and in the end he annoyed me so much I hexed him. When Slughorn came in, I thought I was going to get detention, but he just thought it was a really good hex and invited me to lunch. Mad, eh?"
"Better reason for inviting someone than because their mother's famous," said Harry, scowling at the back of Zabini's head, "or because their uncle—"
But he broke off. An idea had just occurred to him, a reckless but potentially wonderful idea. In a minute's time, Zabini was going to re-enter the Slytherin sixth-year compartment, and Malfoy would be sitting there, thinking himself unheard by anybody except fellow Slytherins. If Harry could only enter unseen behind him, what might he not see or hear? True, there was little of the journey left. Hogsmeade Station had to be less than half an hour away, judging by the wildness of the scenery flashing by the windows. But nobody else seemed prepared to take Harry's suspicions seriously, so it was down to him to prove them. "I'll see you two later," said Harry under his breath, pulling out his invisibility cloak and flinging it over himself.
"But what do you—" asked Neville.
"Later," whispered Harry, darting after Zabini as quietly as possible, though the rattling of the train made such caution almost pointless. The corridors were almost completely empty now. Nearly everyone had returned to their carriages to change into their school robes and pack up their possessions. Though he was as close as he could get to Zabini without touching him, Harry was not quick enough to slip into the compartment when Zabini opened the door. Zabini was already sliding it shut when Harry hastily stuck out his foot to prevent it closing.
"What's wrong with this thing?" said Zabini angrily as he smashed the sliding door repeatedly into Harry's foot.
Harry seized the door and pushed it open hard. Zabini, still clinging onto the handle, toppled over sideways into Gregory Goyle's lap, and, in the ensuing ruckus, Harry darted into the compartment, leapt onto Zabini's temporarily empty seat, and hoisted himself up into the luggage rack. It was fortunate that Goyle and Zabini were snarling at each other, drawing all eyes onto them, for Harry was quite sure his feet and ankles had been revealed as the cloak had flapped around them. Indeed, for one horrible moment he thought he saw Malfoy's eyes follow his trainer as it whipped upwards out of sight. But then Goyle slammed the door shut and flung Zabini off him. Zabini collapsed into his own seat looking ruffled, Vincent Crabbe returned to his comic, and Malfoy, sniggering, lay back down across two seats with his head in Pansy Parkinson's lap. Harry lay curled uncomfortably under the cloak to ensure that every inch of him remained hidden, and watched Pansy stroke the sleek blonde hair off Malfoy's forehead, smirking as she did so, as though anyone would have loved to have been in her place. The lantern swinging from the carriage ceiling cast a bright light over the scene. Harry could read every word of Crabbe's comic directly below him.
"So, Zabini," said Malfoy, "what did Slughorn want?" "Just trying to make up to well-connected people," said Zabini, who was still glowering at Goyle. "Not that he managed to find many."
This information did not seem to please Malfoy.
"Who else had he invited?" he demanded.
"McLagan from Gryffindor," said Zabini.
"Oh, yeah, his uncle's big in the Ministry," said Malfoy. "Someone else called Belby from Ravenclaw."
"Not him, he's a prat," said Pansy.
"And Longbottom, Potter, and that Weasley girl," finished Zabini.
Malfoy sat up very suddenly, knocking Pansy's hand aside.
"He invited Longbottom?" "Well, I assume so, as Longbottom was there," said Zabini indifferently.
"What's Longbottom got to interest Slughorn?"
Zabini shrugged.
"Potter, precious Potter! Obviously he wanted a look at the Chosen One," sneered Malfoy. "But that Weasley girl, what's so special about her?" "A lot of boys like her," said Pansy, watching Malfoy out of the corner of her eyes for his reaction. "Even you think she's good-looking, don't you, Blaze? And we all know how hard you are to please."
"I wouldn't touch a filthy little blood traitor like her, whatever she looked like," said Zabini coldly, and Pansy looked pleased.
Malfoy sank back across her lap and allowed her to resume the stroking of his hair.
"Well, I pity Slughorn's taste. Maybe he's going a bit senile. Shame. My father always said he was a good wizard in his day. My father used to be a bit of a favourite of his. Slughorn probably hasn't heard I'm on the train, or I wouldn't bank on an invitation," said Zabini. "He asked me about Knott's father when I first arrived. They used to be old friends, apparently, but when he heard he'd been caught at the ministry, he didn't look happy, and Knott didn't get an invitation, did he? I don't think Slughorn's interested in Death Eaters."
Malfoy looked angry, but forced out a singularly humourless laugh.
"Well, who cares what he's interested in? What is he, when you come down to it, just some stupid teacher?"
Malfoy yawned ostentatiously.
"I mean, I might not even be at Hogwarts next year. What's it matter to me if some fat old has-been likes me or not?"
"What do you mean you might not be at Hogwarts next year?" said Pansy indignantly, ceasing grooming Malfoy at once.
"Well, you never know," said Malfoy with the ghost of a smirk. "I might have moved on to bigger and better things."
Crouched in the luggage rack under his cloak, Harry's heart began to race. What would Ron and Hermione say about this? Crabbe and Goyle were gawping at Malfoy. Apparently they had had no inkling of any plans to move on to bigger and better things. Even Zabini had allowed a look of curiosity to mar his haughty features. Pansy resumed the slow stroking of Malfoy's hair, looking dumbfounded.
"Do you mean him?"
Malfoy shrugged.
"Mother wants me to complete my education, but personally I don't see it as that important these days. I mean, think about it. When the Dark Lord takes over, is he going to care about how many OWLs or NEWTs anyone's got? Of course he isn't. It'll be all about the kind of service he received, the level of devotion he was shown."
"And you think you will be able to do something for him?" asked Zabini scathingly. 16 years old and not even fully qualified yet."
"I've just said, haven't I? Maybe he doesn't care if I'm qualified. Maybe the job he wants me to do isn't something that you need to be qualified for," said Malfoy quietly.
Crabbe and Goyle were both sitting with their mouths open like gargoyles. Pansy was gazing down at Malfoy as though she had never seen anything so awe-inspiring.
"I can see Hogwarts," said Malfoy, clearly relishing the effect he had created, as he pointed out of the blackened window. "We'd better get our robes on."
Harry was so busy staring at Malfoy, he did not notice Goyle reaching up for his trunk. As he swung it down, it hit Harry hard on the side of the head. He let out an involuntary gasp of pain, and Malfoy looked up at the luggage rack, frowning. Harry was not afraid of Malfoy, but he still did not much like the idea of being discovered hiding under his invisibility cloak by a group of unfriendly Slytherins. Eyes still watering and head still throbbing, he drew his wand, careful not to disarrange the cloak, and waited, breath held. To his relief, Malfoy seemed to decide that he had imagined the noise. He pulled on his robes like the others, locked his trunk, and, as the train slowed to a jerky crawl, fastened a thick new travelling cloak round his neck. Harry could see the corridors filling up again, and hoped that Hermione and Ron would take his things out onto the platform for him. He was stuck where he was until the compartment had quite emptied. At last, with a final lurch, the train came to a complete halt. Goyle threw the door open and muscled his way out into a crowd of second years, punching them aside. Crabbe and Zabini followed.
"You go on," Malfoy told Pansy, who was waiting for him with her hand held out as though hoping he would hold it. "I just want to check something."
Pansy left. Now Harry and Malfoy were alone in the compartment. People were filing past, descending onto the dark platform. Malfoy moved over to the compartment door and let down the blinds, so that people in the corridor beyond could not peer in. He then bent down over his trunk and opened it again. Harry peered down over the edge of the luggage rack, his heart pumping a little faster. What had Malfoy wanted to hide from Pansy? Was he about to see the mysterious broken object it was so important to mend?
Petrificus totalus!
Without warning, Malfoy pointed his wand at Harry, who was instantly paralysed. As though in slow motion, he toppled out of the luggage rack and fell with an agonising, floor-shaking crash at Malfoy's feet, the invisibility cloak trapped beneath him, his whole body revealed, with his legs still curled absurdly into the cramped kneeling position. He couldn't move a muscle. He could only gaze up at Malfoy, who smiled broadly.
"I thought so," he said jubilantly. "I heard Goyle's trunk hit you, and I thought I saw something white flash through the air after Zabini came back."
His eyes lingered for a moment upon Harry's trainers.
"That was you blocking the door when Zabini came back in, I suppose?"
He considered Harry for a moment.
"You didn't hear anything I care about, Potter, but while I've got you here."
And he stamped hard on Harry's face. Harry felt his nose break. Blood spurted everywhere.
"That's from my father. Now, let's see."
Malfoy dragged the cloak out from under Harry's immobilized body and threw it over him. "I don't reckon they'll find you till the train's back in London," he said quietly. "See you around, Potter, or not." And taking care to tread on Harry's fingers, Malfoy left the compartment.